Welcome back to Open Source Startup Podcast. This is Tim from Essence VC and our lovely co-host Robbie from Cowboy Ventures. And we're super excited to have Elliot, CEO and founder of VM, who was also previously the co-founder of MongoDB. So welcome, Elliot.
Thanks, and thanks for having me.
Awesome. Well, we're super, super excited to have you on. And before we get into the VM story, we're going to start with the Mongo story. So can you give us just like kind of, I know there's a ton that we could talk about there, but just a brief overview of how Mongo was started, where the idea initially came from, and then we can talk a lot about learnings and then how you're applying them to your new company.
Absolutely. So in 2007, I was working with one of my partners and my other venture and friend, Dwight Merriman, and we were trying to figure out what we were going to do next. We had a number of interesting products we wanted to build. And every product we wanted to build, we knew there were going to be database problems. How did we know that? Because everything we had tried to do in software for the previous decade always turned into a database problem. Whether that was a DoubleClick or ShopWiki, it didn't matter, right? Everything was a database problem. And the more we thought about the apps we were going to build and the database problems, we realized we were actually more excited about the database problem and actually solving that once and for all than we were about the actual other applications. So we were like, okay, could we build a database that is the database that we want to use for everything else we're going to do that actually just works, that makes startups and other companies not have to worry about databases so much? You know, I don't think people remember that much these days, but 15 years ago, if you were talking to a bunch of, you know, VCs or startup founders, like database problems were a thing. And now, like, databases kind of work, whether you're using Mongo or other things, but like the database industry has completely changed in the last 15 years. And so that's what we set out to do.
Yeah, and there's so much nuggets and lessons. We hopefully can touch a little bit of the Mongo journey. And so maybe you can talk about like what was the biggest driver for you to be able to get the early success for Mongo? Like what was the things or biggest challenge or lessons you learned trying to grow from like zero to first 1,000 users of using Mongo? Was there anything particular at that time?
I mean, it's so many things, right? It's everything from, you know, you've got to make the barrier to entry zero, right? You know, we used to work on optimizing, you know, even down to the seconds, how long it took you to come to the Mongo website, download it, try it, do something. Because, you know, the other lesson is engineers don't believe marketing. The only thing engineers believe is themselves doing something. Another lesson. And the only content people ever trust is user-generated content. Doesn't mean you cannot write content. It just means that a lot of what you have to do is get users to be in love with your product by having success with it. So they end up going and writing, right? Your best marketing is successful users.
So if you can take us through, it's funny, we've had a lot of founders on here that are later stage, might be public company CEOs. And I think like from the outside, it sometimes seems like it was much easier than it was, or things were really up and to the right from the start. So like 2007, Mongo was founded. Like how long did it take for things to really click? And what were some of those major unlocks or like moments where you were like, oh wow, like we're really getting wide adoption or we're getting the type of adoption we want? Like what were some of those like real highlight moments for you?
So we started building it in 2007. We didn't launch the beta until early 2009. In June of 2009, we had some people who were like, why is this still here? Like, shouldn't you shut this down now? Like you don't have users yet. Like just shut it down already. Like give up. In the fall of 2009, we started to get some traction. At that time, Twitter was considering moving everything to Cassandra. Early 2010, people were like, yeah, Cassandra is going to win. This is when Cloudera and Hadoop, Cloudera raised like $1 billion. And it was like, oh, between Cloudera and Cassandra, Mongo's doomed. Like, how could they survive? Then over the course of like 3 months, like we got a bunch of interesting users that we could talk about. We hosted our first event in San Francisco that was sold out. Twitter decided not to migrate everything to Cassandra. And by the end of 2010, it was clear that Mongo was sort of legit. There was no like one thing. Like the thing that I remember being like, oh, okay, maybe this is actually going to work was our first Mongo event. We did it in San Francisco in April of 2010, and we sold it out in like 48 hours. It wasn't huge. It was like 200 people. But like it was still like, oh, we sold this thing out in 48 hours. Like that's pretty cool. And then we did it again in New York in a few months, and that sold out. And we did it again in the Valley in December of 2010, and that sold out. And I was like, okay, I guess this is actually real. Let's go.
I'm curious because I think prior to Mongo, there probably are other examples that I cannot really think of, but Mongo definitely seems to be the definitive example of having your users, your practitioners love the product And it starts to keep spreading and continue to be used a lot in more and more production cases where the Calderas of the world, the DataStacks of the world, like these platforms, you never have a single developer go download Cassandra or set up Hadoop, right? These are like monumental stuff, or OpenStack, CloudStack, any example we've seen, even like Oracles or Postgres, most of these are, you can use a single user, but most of the time they have to be like a DBA with the whole thing set up and the whole engagement. But Mongo seems a very different approach from day one.
Literally in 2009, I can't tell you the number of hours I personally spent optimizing the download times, the compiled times, the build times, the like literally everything from you come into the website to you being able to actually have a good experience with the database. Like I spent enormous amounts of time just like literally like bit twiddling to how to make this work faster and faster. Like it was a lot, but it worked. My general feeling on products like this is you basically got, you know, someone comes to your website, someone sees something, whatever. You've got about 10 seconds to convince them to spend 30 seconds. You've got those 30 seconds to convince them to spend 2 minutes. You've got those 2 minutes to convince them to spend 5 minutes. 5 minutes got to convince them to spend 30 minutes. If you're trying to get them to go from a tweet to 2 hours to like install and set up a product, like don't even bother. Like you're doomed. Never going to happen. It's got to be incredibly easy, incredibly fast.
And so what are the major objections? Probably maybe your investors or even some other folks are telling you, because this is probably not the normal path most database companies will take, is to try to get everybody to optimize the usage and love from early on. They'll probably ask you, hey, will they upsell, right? Will you able to get to, you know, sell the same similar fashion or not, right? Why don't you just focus on larger deployments? Do you get that at all? Or
did we get that early on? Of course. Our VCs are pretty good in terms of like understanding the longer term vision. But it requires a long-term plan, a long-term conviction, and a long-term revenue plan that doesn't optimize early revenue. Right? We very adamantly did not optimize for our revenue in the first 3 years. You know, there are pros and cons, right? We had to give away a lot more of the company because of that, because we had to raise more money. On the other hand, the foundation we laid is going to, you know, Mongo's growing fast now, right? It's you know, a big company, over a billion dollars in revenue company, and it's still growing fast and it'll continue to grow fast because the foundation is solid. So you gotta, you know, I think companies have to make choices. It's very hard to fix the foundation later. It's very hard to start super enterprisey sales and like build sort of not the right product or go consulting heavy or over optimize or a niche that maybe can get your early revenues, but then try to generalize, right? We adamantly were like, no, we're building a general purpose database. We got a lot of, not necessarily like, hey, go do this kind of enterprise go-to-market motion, but hey, why don't you focus on this market, this vertical, this use case? Easier to monetize a single use case in the first 3 years. We were like, no. And that was, there were a couple of board meetings with some quotes that I'll never forget. But like, it, you know, paid off in the end.
And so for anyone starting a database company today, I think it's more obvious the benefits of it being open source. But in 2007, like you just didn't have that many examples to kind of go off of. Like, how did you come to that decision? Was it like 100% like, yes, it's going to be open source, here's why? Or like, how did you think about that piece of it?
Even in 2007, right? I'm a bit older. So MySQL started to get legitimately used in 2001, which is around also the same time that Linux started to get legitimately used. Right, DoubleClick before 2000, it was all Oracle Solaris. That was it. 2000, 2001, you started to see some Linux creeping in, you started to see some MySQL creeping in. By 2007, MySQL and Postgres wasn't really on the map. I mean, Postgres was considered pretty academic in 2007. I don't think I remember anyone really using Postgres commercially in 2007. I'm sure there were. Later, it became more popular. But MySQL was obviously big commercially in 2007. We had used it a lot commercially. And Oracle had lost its luster by 2007. So it was pretty obvious to us in 2007 that if you wanted to have that kind of a product, right, an infrastructure product at the database layer, at the core of it had to be open source or it was kind of a non-starter. MySQL obviously wasn't huge yet. It wasn't what it is today yet, but like it was obvious that like trying to go compete with MySQL as a new thing isn't going to start. Also, it changes the nature, you know, how do you get, you know, what is the motion? If you're going to go for a developer first motion, open source makes that so much easier. In so many ways. And it's not because people are going to go fix the code. It's not because people are even like auditing the code or submitting. It's just because it gives people a level of comfort and trust. It forces your hand in the way that you write the software. It just does all these other things that are so beneficial. And it's a huge trust thing.
Yeah, the trust angle is one, especially for database companies, like is super, super important. I guess from a community standpoint, so there are most likely then way less examples to go off of as far as like, how do you build a successful open source community? And so like, how did you think about that part of it? Because I imagine coming from like DoubleClick, like the how I'm going to build an open source community, it was a probably newer thing, a newer muscle. So like, how did you learn that? And what were some of the toughest parts?
We really did very little, right? We did all the basic things people did. We did meetups, we did these things. The thing that we did better than everyone else was we and me personally, if someone asked a question in, at that point, it was IRC or Google Forums, we answered ridiculously fast, as close to 24/7 as we could, considering we had like four engineers in New York. It became a board level issue about how often I was responding to questions within 30 seconds, 24/7. They were like, Elliot, this isn't sustainable. I'm like, I'll do it for 3 years, 5 years. It'll be fine. And that's what I did, right? Literally, I spent 3 or 4 years responding to every single question as fast as I possibly could. Literally as close to 24/7 as I could sustain. And that works, right? And if you think about it practically, well, that seems fast. Like 30 minutes versus 30 seconds versus 30 minutes versus 3 hours. Like, does it really matter? You're an engineer drawing a product. Something doesn't work. You Google, you can't find an answer. You go to their support system. You submit, you know, like, hey, this thing doesn't work. If you don't get a response for 3 hours, what happens in those 3 hours? You move on. If they respond in 3 hours with the answer to your question, but you were testing it out to see if it was interesting, and you make 3 hours, what are the odds you come back to use that product? It's not zero, but it's low. If instead you get an answer in 30 seconds that solves your problem or starts a communication that solves your problem, two things happen. One is you're unblocked. You keep going. You use the product. Two is you have such a level of like, wow, okay, they care. They give a shit. When I have real problems later, because this is a startup, right? They're going to have problems. Right? No database startup, no infrastructure startup is going to be perfect. Like, it's possible. If there are problems later, they've got my back. You can go look at the forums. Oh, this is not a one-off. I didn't get lucky. This is a pattern. That is absolutely enormous. Now, sounds easy, but it literally is. It's like, it's impossible, right? You just have to, you know, work 24/7. That's all. There are probably ways to not work 24/7 and pull that off. If there are, I don't know what they are.
Yeah, I think that's the magic pill everybody tried to find. We'll have to talk about the VM story really quickly. But, you know, I think just to kind of hone down the last question about the early side, there's so much choices you can make when it comes to building new databases and also like what to focus on. And I think the story of TenGen actually been talked about quite a bit, especially the early days of choosing not to build a GUI, for example, right? Or, you know, doing a bunch of choices to try to figure out how to grow with a small team. What are some of the choices you think you made when it comes to like choosing the focus on the products and also the target audience that really paid off? And is there anything that didn't pay off? Just wanted to learn like some of the major experiments that worked and didn't work.
Yeah, so I think the major experiments that worked were really focusing on the long-term groundswell, building a general purpose product, right? That was the thing that really worked. I mean, lots of things that didn't work, right? You know, if you look at how Mongo tried to monetize early, it was what at then was considered standard open source commercialization strategy. So enterprise closed source features in the database, support, consulting, those sorts of things. None of those are great businesses. Most of Mongo's revenue now is cloud services. That was probably the biggest one. We spent a lot of time. Now, maybe there was no way around it because the world changed and we sort of saw it coming, but like we were trying to, right, the world was moving to cloud. We were coming this way and we had to find the middle point. So maybe we couldn't have, maybe we had to do what we did. We'll never know. But like there's clearly this battle between, okay, the future is going to be cloud. And we always thought that the real future of the revenue for Mongo was going to be cloud. But in 2010, there was no cloud database revenue anywhere. So it was hard to go and say, we're going to bet the company on cloud database revenue in 2010 and ignore all this on-premise monetization. So that was sort of a very strong battle internally and publicly for a long time until it became pretty obvious that cloud and, you know, Mongo Atlas was the future. But it was probably a decade-long battle.
Yeah, I think market timing around like now it's very obvious how fast cloud adoption happened, but it was probably like much less clear in like 2010. I do want to make sure that we get a good amount of time to talk about the VM story. So this is your third time as a founder. Did you want to found something else again, or did you see the opportunity with VM and you're like, okay, I have to go after this? Like, how did the idea come about? And maybe you can touch on what VM is a little bit too.
Yeah. So I left Mongo in March of 2020. It had been 13 years. And it was like, you know, I said at the beginning, you know, we set out to solve the database problem. And I was like, okay, I think we solved the database problem. 13 seemed like a good year. It was like time to move on. And I didn't know what I was going to do next. It was very much a, let's just see what happens. There were options ranging from nothing to I dabbled in investing and decided I was a terrible investor and didn't enjoy investing. I appreciate those who do, but not my cup of tea. So then I was looking at sort of problems that mattered to me. So I was looking at climate change. I was looking at cleaning oceans. And the thing that became quickly apparent was that a huge part of the solution has to be labor, right? You want to clean oceans, you need people to do it. You want to plant a trillion trees to take carbon dioxide out of the air? Like, okay, cool. Why aren't we planting a trillion trees? So that's a lot of people planting trees. We want to get all the plastic out of the ocean. Cool. How do we get a million people into the oceans cleaning them? Well, that's not going to happen. Great. Robots, right? Why are my kids not cleaning the dinner table? I can be a robot. Why does my Roomba not work? Okay, that's a robot problem. It was very clear that like labor was sort of the bottleneck to solving a lot of the problems that I cared about. For a long time, I feel like people were being told, Rosie is coming. Rosie from the Jetsons, for those who don't know the reference, is coming any day now. And she's going to come and fix everything. Still don't see it, right? Not happening. So I was like, cool, let's go figure out why. So I bought some hardware, bought a robot arm, started, you know, put it in my living room. I got a little bit different than most people. And I was like, let's go play with it. So I made it play chess against me. And the chess part was easy because open source chess programs are amazing. And the robotic side of the software was like, this is how people write software in the robotics world. And I was like, this makes no sense. So then we hired a few people. We spent about 6 months trying to figure out what the first product should be, right? We were like, okay, how do we find an inroad into the space that isn't massive? And like, how do we find this path into the robotic space to actually have an impact and make this space better? So after 6 months, we came up with the conclusion that what we were trying to do was impossible. And we said, there is no small inroad into the space. But if you really want to make a difference in the robotic space anytime soon, you have to just go and fix it all, which is terrible advice for most people. So like, and we can come back to like how we're solving that. But it's terrible advice because you need to do a ton. Right. And for a startup to do it a ton is hard. But that's what we set out to do. So starting in the summer of 2021, we started building a whole new robotic stack. Robotics is sort of not the right word, but we can come back to that also. And then we launched it a couple months ago and are, you know, going through the motions and getting people onboarded and doing all the same things we just talked about with Mongo and getting people to start building more things and, you know, putting, you know, having more software engineers comfortable working with hardware products. And whether they're robotics or smart refrigerators, doesn't matter, right? Getting software people and hardware people having an easier time communicating and building all the tools they need to actually go and build great companies that are more software and hardware combined.
This is such a hard problem to solve, right? Database is not an easy problem to solve at all, but robotic has been one of the hardest problems it feels like to go after.
So I think it's hard because it's big. So there's been a ton, what I tell a lot of people is that VM is not doing a lot of science. The science has been done. There's been great science done in commercial spaces and in academics for the last 30 years on robotics, right? All this stuff happening in AI, all obviously highly relevant to robotics. But to solve robotics, you need different kinds of things. So it's a really big engineering problem that hasn't been addressed, which makes sense because the hardware wasn't ready yet. The people in robotics have been more hardware focused. The hardware has been problems. The AI has been problems. So you haven't had software people come to the robotics space and be like, how can we really solve this problem? The closest analogy I have is when, oddly enough, SQL was first created. Because before SQL, people were just like, there, you had hard drive vendors, and hard drive vendors were like doing crazy, cool, cutting edge work on making hard drives actually usable. Or you've all seen the crazy pictures of hard drives that were like 5 megabytes that were the size of like a shipping container, right? And they kept getting smaller and smaller. Now in the, you know, 60s, you could actually like put some real data on something that wasn't a shipping container size hard drive. So you had hardware vendors giving APIs to software engineers on how to use the hardware to store data, which made a lot of sense because that was, you know, and at some point someone was like, hey, look, there needs to be a layer here, right? There needs to be tools so that your normal software engineers can work with the hardware without having to like, and that hasn't happened in the space yet in any real way. And so that's what we're solving for.
So it's funny. I actually started my venture career investing in robotics. It was a company called Six River Systems that was building an autonomous mobile robot. It was an ex-Kiva Systems team. And one of the things that we struggled with was having like top-notch Silicon Valley software engineers join, because it does seem like there's this divide in the types of use cases where they're like, a lot of the use cases for robots are industrial use cases or logistics and just like kind of different sectors. Is that like similar today? Because that was a number of years ago. Or are you finding there is a lot more interest and like a lot broader set of use cases that are kind of bringing more traditional software engineers into the space?
Half of what you said is correct. Half is still not there. So there's more and more interest in the space, in ag tech and construction and all these spaces and warehouse robotics, right? There's way more interest in the robotic space and sort of the broader robotic space, because I think about the word differently. We'll come back to that. We can come back to that. Your average software engineer is still completely uninterested and intimidated by robotics, right? And it makes total sense. So, you know, look, a lot of people who are software people, me included, were like, cool, like I would love to do things and automate things in my house. And you get an Arduino and you start fucking around with an Arduino and then you kind of make it real. And you're like, I'm running this weird C++ variant head. Like, I'm not trying to knock Arduino. They're doing cool stuff, but like the hardware is great. Again, Arduino is a very cool hardware company. They've got some software stuff, but it's not the software platform that's going to take robotics from a hobbyist to a like letting 30 million software engineers make practical progress, right? Even the language choices, robotics, the entire robot space, the choices are C++ and Python or like other weird industrial stuff. Neither is a good language for robotics. Very few parts of robotics have to be C++ from a performance standpoint. Python is not a language that, in my opinion, should be used for sort of high-end mission critical systems. So there are great languages out there today. Rust, Go, TypeScript, right? There's, you know, all the language people know, like, why can't people use those languages? They should be able to. It shouldn't even matter what language you use. Use whatever you want. Who cares? It's 2023. Like, there's great languages out there. Use whatever you want. So the software world is not quite there yet. And that is one of the big things that we will be focused on is how to get the software world there. And one of the big things that we focus on and that I focus on is bridging the hardware world and the software world. So I'm going to, again, date myself again. But in the early 2000s, late 90s, you had a lot of database engineers. And these weren't people building databases. These were people at companies being the gatekeepers for databases. Today, you've got robotics engineers. There will always be a need for people with highly specialized skills that sit on the hardware side and the software side. You can do both to do interesting science and do really hard problems. But most people are either going to be on the hardware side, like on the mechanical side, or on the software side. And one of the main goals of VM is to bridge those two worlds so you can more effectively have hardware people and software people working together, where neither side has to be an expert on the other person's side. A hardware person shouldn't have to be a software expert. A software person shouldn't have to be a hardware expert. Why? Because trying to be an expert on both is too much. You can't do it.
And maybe you can talk a bit about how ROS fits into this, because that seems to be in some way the like open source set of middleware tools that are like trying to do what VM's doing. And did you look at that and say, okay, like there's a bunch of things we could do better? Or, like, how do they fit into the world as you see it?
You know, ROS in some ways has very similar philosophical goals to what we do, but the underpinnings of ROS are very research and academic. And I don't think it's possible without starting from scratch in order to make all the changes necessary in order for ROS to become the production platform of choice. Now, it is the de facto standard today because it is the only game in town, but VM is a full replacement for ROS. Or if you are using ROS and you're happy with it, you can use all the VM cloud set stuff without replacing the ROS side of it, right? VM is incredibly flexible about how you use it. It's very flexible, very pluggable, very modular.
Your Mongo focus was trying to get people to able to use and try, right? That sort of seconds to minutes. Robotics obviously is a lot harder, but you know, signing up to your website, you can move a rover in your office in 10 minutes. I think that's a super intriguing way to get started. I wonder, there probably has a lot of choices here, because when we build robotics, there's so many modules, there's so many things involved, right?
So, I mean, let's dig into that for a second. Why do you think that? Obviously, there's hardware.
Yeah.
But like, there are ways to work around that. But like, why are there so many modules? Like, why are there so many things? Like, it doesn't have to be that way, right?
That
is a fact of the past that has been true historically, which is why you think it. And that is the assumption that software people make about hardware, but it is not a truism, right? It does not have to be true. That is exactly the belief and the how people think about the space that we are trying to change and trying to address.
That's true. Yeah. But I guess for us as a software developer, trying to understand because as a developer, you're trying to understand how things work, you know, diving into immediately just seeing the SDK, like, okay, here's the remote controls, here's all the orientations. I mean, you're necessary to understand how to do some things, but.
Well, it depends what you want to do. Let's say you want to, so I believe in very simple tutorials. So we have a tutorial on our website for making a plant watering robot. Mm-hmm. It's super simple. The amount of code is super simple, right? It's like, yeah. Cool, you buy a Raspberry Pi, a moisture meter, and a water pump. And you could go and automatically measure the moisture in your plants and give it the right amount of water. It is super simple, right? Any software engineer could do it in half an hour. It's super simple. You need to know the communication layer. And we have drivers to connect VM to different motor pumps. Do you need to know how those drivers work? Absolutely mm-hmm. not. Do you know how your database worked? No. Historically, you've had to know how those things work because the abstractions weren't great and the systems were flaky and you had to debug them.
Got it. I see.
Right. No one cares about how their database talks to their hard drive. Yeah. Some people do, and that's fine, people like me. But like most people don't need to, and they shouldn't have to know. You should know that, hey, I want to use this motor. There's a driver for this motor. I can call this method on this driver, and it does something. That's all you need to know. If you want to go dig in, cool. It's all open source. Go dig in all you want. Go have fun. But to actually get something done, you shouldn't need to know that.
Yeah, I see. So the hope, or I guess the goal is to actually have developers just able to learn just enough to do what you want with a pretty typical robotics setup. Because, you know, I guess in my mind, robotics are all kinds, right? You know, not all of them have the same exact hardware, not all of them have the same exact function. So exactly. When you have a generic SDK, how do you abstract it in a way? It's like...
So one of the big first things we had to do was figure out the abstractions for the hardware and abstractions to the algorithms that we thought made the most sense, right? Because again, if you don't have the right topology for hardware, then you're going to come up with a bunch of ridiculous APIs. So that was actually one of the very first things we had to really do was dig into that. And how did we do it? Well, we built a lot of stupid robots in our office and a bunch of random shit. And we're like, okay, like I got to build this and now I got to build this. And we just kept building shit. And we had a lab and we were, you know, nothing caught on fire, but you know, we melted some stuff. You know, like, we just have to like play with stuff and like just experiment, right? There's no like, none of us knew a priori. Here's the topology. We're going to just like set, you know, go to a whiteboard and just draw it out. And like, here's the topology for how you build robots. Like, we had no idea. Every thought we had on day zero, almost all of them proved to be wrong. And that's fine, right? That was sort of the expectation. We're going to go and experiment by just building stuff and seeing what happens.
And so VM, in the near term, are you building it for everyone, including like hobbyists and also people getting into robotics development, or also for the like production use cases that are already there? Like, is it broader or more focused?
It's both. It is great for hobbyists. It is great for startups, for enterprises. Maybe they've got a robot that already works and they're not going to go use it on their robot, but they want to use it for code deployment or data management or machine learning pipelines. It's fine. Again, you can pick and choose which pieces of it you want to use. If you don't want to use a piece, don't use it. You want to go write your own SLAM algorithm or your own computer vision algorithm and not use what we have out of the box? Fine. That's pluggable. Okay. Everything is pluggable in a very easy way. Everything's modular. And we're making it easier and easier for people to just like write their own drivers, write their own algorithm, plug them in, building, you know, kind of like Lego for robotics, but in a not toy way.
And how did you decide what was important to include? And like, what pieces are you finding like resonate the most? Or like, just because it is such a broad platform, there's so much you could build. Like, where did you start and how did you make that decision?
So two ways we made the decision. One was, again, building lots of things. The more things we build, the more we're going to know. Like, if we can't build stuff successfully on the platform easily, then it's not done. And then two was just talking to potential users, like just all the time, right? And that doesn't necessarily mean you listen to everything they say. The great quote, you know, if I ask people what they wanted, they'd say a faster horse. But like, you have to understand people's problems and the things they worry about every day. And so it's those two things, right? Building stuff to form your own opinions and then talking to users to see what's actually driving them crazy on a daily basis.
And so you're open source now as well.
Yep. So everything... So the distinction is everything that lives on a robot is open source. The cloud side of it is commercial. Why do we do it that way? A few big reasons. We want more and more robots to be in the world. The IoT space, which we think is actually a subset of the robotic space, has not exactly had a great security and privacy track record. Security and privacy for us are 100% paramount in everything we do. If you're going to put a robot in your house that has a camera on it, you're going to damn well want to know what's happening with that camera data, that it can't leave your house, that you control that data. Otherwise, you are not going to put a camera in your house, right? That can move around. Like, that's crazy, right? So we have to build a ton of security stuff in it. And how do you prove that you're doing the right things on security and privacy? Open it up, right? Everything we do on that side of it, all open source. Just go look, right? Have whatever security researcher they want, audit it, right? It's like Tangent. We also have like SOC 2 and HIPAA on the web. You know, when we beta launched, we had SOC 2 because we were like, privacy and security matters so much in this space. I have this joke that I use sometimes, was, can your Roomba kill you? The answer is yes. Not easily, but like, you purposely, you know, someone moves it around at night to like, you know, so you step out of bed in the middle of the night and you trip on, like, there are ways, right? Like, having robots in your house means security and privacy have to be incredibly important. One big reason. Two is, again, we're building infrastructure software. I think all infrastructure software that people are building on top of is going to have to be open source, because no one's going to want to build stuff for an ecosystem that is closed source. Three, we need people to build drivers and modules and plugins and all these things for Veeam to be successful. Again, no one wants to do that for closed source software. It's harder to do for closed source software. Everything's open source. So everything on the robot is open source.
And how do you think about building community this time around? Are you also trying to adhere to responding to like customers and users incredibly quickly? Or like, does that not matter as much for this community? Like, what are you taking and leaving behind from your community strategy?
That matters just as much. It's a little harder or a little bit bigger. Kind of figure out exactly how to do that, since I can't quite do it 24/7 anymore. A little older now than I was 2007. But that matters a ton. The hardest part about the community here, the biggest difference, is something that Tim touched on a little bit, which is that with purely software, anyone can play with anything 24/7 immediately. With this, if you don't have hardware lying around, you're a little bit more stuck, right? So we have the try VM experience. You can play with a robot in our office, drive it around, write code, and you can do that really quickly. And that, we have over 100 people doing that every day, just playing with robots, writing code against robots in our office. But that is a challenge, right? And so we're working on different ways to solve that by doing more things in our office where you can like borrow robots, by doing more events in our office where you can come in and play with hardware, by making, you know, kits that, you know, that are cheap so people can go and like learn stuff that aren't like, they don't feel like toys. So like, you know, working on these things.
And I see you have some early customers using your product already. And so I've talked to some robotics startups in the past. It seems like it's very hard to get people started because people need to actually, you know, first understand how the SDK works. And then, you know, some of them are very early, don't even have all the hardware spec'd out yet. So you have to test how does your driver, and lots of like some consulting integration required in some level. And I know that's usually needed for all startups, but hardware, I wonder, is there any early lessons you learned already trying to even get your product to be used in production? Was there any particular thing that is so different than in your prior ventures here? Or they're pretty similar journeys, pretty much.
Pretty similar. People are people, you know. Engineers in one space are mostly the same as engineers in other spaces. Right? Engineers don't believe marketing. They want things to make their lives easier. They are distrustful of new products, right? Like they want handholding. They don't want to waste it, you know, they don't need to waste their time, right? Like it's all kind of the same thing, right? How do you get people excited about your product and use it? You show it value quickly. You show, how am I going to save you time? Not over the next 3 years, but over the next 3 weeks. Can I save you time? Can I save you money? Can I get your product to be more widely used faster? All right, can I save you engineering effort? Can I get you to market faster? Can I save you money? Am I going to make your company more successful faster? And you have to prove it to them fast. If you're like, hey, go spend 3 months trying this thing out and come back to us, you will never make any progress.
And at this point in the company journey, like, are you really focused on primarily getting more and more free software robotics users, or are you thinking about paid at this point? Like, I know you have both, but where's your focus?
It's somewhere in the mix, right? We don't really distinguish paid versus commercial. It's all consumption based. So if you're a hobbyist, there's a free tier, but like you're not like, you don't like use one thing and switch to another product. Like, you're just not going to have a lot of, you know, one of the things you charge for, we charge for is like data. If you're a hobbyist, you're not going to really have any data, so you might get a 30-cent bill, and that's in the free tier. So like, it's going to be free. So the way we think about it is sort of, you know, three different kinds of companies or people we talk to, right? One is sort of the hobbyist academic crowd, right? People who are playing with robots, who want to do interesting stuff, who are trying to do research. We've got professors using VM for classes because it's easier for their students to actually start doing the interesting part of robotics as opposed to fighting with tools. That's one whole category, right? Sort of this hobbyist, individual developers, academic bucket. Then you've got another bucket, which I would call the traditional, or what you, when I say robotic startup, it's exactly what comes to mind, right? It's the people working in ag tech and all this kind of stuff. That's a big market. Same thing. Like they're, you know, sometimes it's people starting from scratch. Sometimes it's people who already got stuff and different things there. And other times it's people who are doing other things, whether it's people who've got bigger robotics fleets or people who we see VM is used for a lot of things. IoT is a subset of robotics. So another fun sort of weird mix between IoT and robotics, that this is why I think it's all the same. I feel like for a decade, even hearing that your fridge should know when you're out of milk and order you more milk. That does not exist. The steps to go from where we are today to get there are not obvious. And I don't, and I'm sure there are people working on it, but like I'm not trusting that it's going to happen. So what's a good middle ground? A good product that if you use VM, you can actually get out the door really fast. Okay. Well, let's put a bunch of cameras in your fridge so that when I'm at the supermarket, I could pull up all the cameras on my phone. That's it. Now when I'm shopping, I can go on my phone and be like, oh, cool. I can look at every shelf. I'm doing an Instacart order from my office, from my house. I can just go look at everything in my fridge. Doing that on VM would be easy. Like that's an easy project and incredibly valuable. And then guess what happens? Now you've got a hardware platform with good APIs that any software engineer could go and start trying to make better software for. Now you can get a software upgrade for the cloud for your fridge that can tell you if you're out of milk, but it doesn't have to all be in one thing. Tesla did this with hardware. They got hardware out, started collecting data. They use that data to eventually make software. It's a good model. Other companies should adopt that model, ideally using VM. You know, one thing VM does is make it easy to collect data. Put cameras in a fridge, let you easily see the cameras from anywhere in the world. Start collecting that data. Use that data to start training models to understand how to know when you're out of milk. And then eventually be like, hey, I think you're running low on milk. I think you should order some. But start small and build. Right? Iterate, iterate, iterate.
And I guess one follow-up to that, when you think about the main messages that you want to share with developers who are not yet into robotics at all, is it like, hey, it's much easier than you think it is? And like there's the capabilities that you can have with robots because you have the hardware element are so much greater. Like what are kind of the main messages that you want VM to be able to like tell the like software developer community?
So the main message is twofold. One is that, and I'll say it's the software development community and the hardware community, which is that, hey, you two can work together really easily without sort of super, super specialized skill sets. That you can take a, you know, software engineer and a mechanical engineer and the two of you together can go and build really cool stuff. And two is to encourage people to start small, right? You don't have to build a perfect fridge. You don't have to build a perfect thing. Like build a cat food feeder that can tell me things about my cat, right? Just like when you start thinking about hardware and software together at the edge, where the software then can be easily adapted to what you need, where you can get automatic, you know, remote control and code deployment, and all these things are taken care of for you. So you don't have to go build all the infrastructure. And you could just think about the software and hardware. There are so many cool things you could do. Think about your daily life, right? Like there are so many little things around your house, around your apartment, in the streets outside your house that you're like, you could solve. And the real world's fun. I'm a much bigger fan of the real world than the virtual world. So go try to make the real world better.
Yeah, looking at a Discord of all the built with VMs. Yeah, it actually reminds me of a company I back called Flux AI. A lot of people building different sort of like hardware prototypes and really interesting projects. Yeah, that's really the most fun part of seeing what people built on top of you.
I mean, that's why I love it. Same thing at Mongo, same thing here, right? I love building things that let other engineers build stuff faster and seeing what they do with it. Like that is so much fun.
Yeah. And so I think for the last question, you know, typically we ask really like, what is the biggest advice you give for early founders? And yeah, such an amazing journey. And now I'm going into this new frontier. I'm sure a lot of founders come to you, ask you advice or questions about, you know, how we should do open source company. And we talked to so many of them. Is there one advice that you often give or one particular topic that you talk to almost all of them over and over that you think is actually worth just telling a lot more people up front?
So I said earlier, I'm bad at investing, which probably means I'm bad at advice, but like, we'll just ignore that for the moment. And since I've ignored my own advice, you know, take it with a grain of salt, but you know, look, solve one small problem for some people and then expand from there. You want to have a successful company, like start small and build. And I know I've not followed that for my last two companies, but still the advice I'd give if you just want to have a successful company.
I love it. Well, this has been such a great episode. Thank you so much for doing it with us, Elliot.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.